it is. It's basketball. It's not a fucking soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. My guest on this podcast is Brad Winter from thepickandroll.com.au. He's the author of 5 Sneaky Big Questions Surrounding the 2019-20 NBL Finals. It's a lovely article. I suggest you go and read it. We caught up on Skype on the morning of Thursday, 27th of February, to discuss his article. We go through all the points, the 5 points in his article, one by one, and we also have a bit of a powwow about the Southeast Melbourne Phoenix and NBL 20 at the end there, if you're interested. Just a couple of reminder, a couple of things going on with NBL Pocket Podcast. We've got the YouTube channel. I did a video called the Cam Luke Cup, which is a playoff between the Brisbane Bullets and the Melbourne United. That was a lot of fun. So that's at YouTube or even on Twitter, you can find it. And also my last podcast with Body Nodge, which was a NBL 20 season in review, and we prescribed a song to each team that sums up their season. But my episode today is with Brad Winter. Very excited about this one. A reminder, rate, review, and subscribe the show if you like what you hear. Without any more delay, this is Brad. Brad Winter. It's such a... It rolls off the tongue. It's a nice sounding name. You know, if you say, that's a name of distinction. When I first heard Brad Winter, I thought, oh, that's a... Do I know it? It's a name I thought I'd heard before. You must be proud of it.
Oh, yeah. I've also heard every pun in the book about it as well.
give me some of them.
Oh, just like, you know, when you're in high school and the teacher's reading off the roll, they go, oh, Brad Winter, oh, Brad Summer, Brad Spring. You know, they'll just roll down
those,
the list. And...
Those school teachers, they're comedy stylings of every high school teacher here enough.
Of course.
You're here. Let's talk about your article, which is on the Pick and Roll. It's called 5 Sneaky Big Questions Surrounding the 19-20 NBL Finals. Yep. You posed 5 of them. Let's go through them one by one. So let's start with number one. The title of this sort of sneaky big question is, can the Cairns Taipans turn Damian Martin into a negative? Would you mind explaining for everyone the crux of your argument with this one?
Yeah, so like, a little while ago, I looked at how every team went about defending Bryce Cotton and the Wildcats for an article that I did last month, I think. And basically what I found is that the Taipans are like super aggressive with their defensive schemes. And a big part of that aggressive nature is like that they help off Martin quite a lot, like a pretty bold manner. Yeah. And that obviously allows them to send double teams at Cotton and send an extra body into the paint, what have you. And the idea here is that when Cairns do that, if they do it right, they can sort of turn Martin into a bit of a negative and force Perth to play 4-on-5 on offense.
All right. Do you feel like when you looked at those games in this, what did you think of Mitch Norton? What role did he play in if Martin becomes a negative? Does he come in? What did you make of that?
Yeah, he comes in. Like Mitch always does a good job, and he's been really good this whole season. And he obviously just adds a better floor spacer in there. He does a little bit more with the ball in his hands as well. But he obviously doesn't bring the level of defense that Damian Martin brings, which is sort of the cat and mouse game they're playing in this final series, I guess.
I had a look at it and I thought, I'll have a look at what they did last year in the grand final, in particular Martin, right? Last year's grand final, because I ignored the Brisbane series. I didn't think Brisbane were in and around the level to really take a solid look at. Last year's grand final, Martin played an average of 23.5 minutes. In the one loss, he played 19 minutes 40. I think that was a blowout, though. I can't really remember. 1 of 6 from the field, 0 of 4 from the outside. To play devil's advocate on your article and the videos you chose, Brad, yeah. That first video, the ball gets to Damian Martin. He misses a 3-point shot in the corner. He's left wide open by Machado, who really doesn't even play. He plays semi-aggressive defense on this particular instance, but it gets to him at that... Damian Martin is making that catch with 4 seconds left on the shot clock. My question is it more crucial what happens when Martin gets that ball and shoots it, or what happens with the preceding 20 seconds in the shot clock, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, like just helping off Martin sort of just allows him to stifle the rest of that game, which is the most important part, even more important than making Martin shoot. Right. So if you see, I think just before he shot the ball, Kay and Cotton were running a dribble handoff, which is usually like one of their best players. And Machado sort of just parks himself around the key, and that just forces them to swing it around to Martin. That's that's probably the, that's definitely the most important part of that play, I'd say.
All right. In the second video, it's a play where they just help off. If the ball goes into Dario Hunt and Martin's just – he waltzes into the keyway, but they don't, he's not unmarked. My biggest – obviously, I saw – you definitely saw your point from your article. What I also saw was Dario Hunt, who's no longer with the Wildcats. I saw him struggle to keep Majuk Deng on his back in the post and misses a spinning shot that really was sort of well within his wheelhouse to make, that I don't think Nick Kay or Plumlee make that same mistake. And then the other thing about that video is I think Hunt shoots it and then Kay grabs a rebound but falls out of bounds. And I thought that, to play devil's advocate, that is where I was, what drew my eye in that video. What do you think?
Oh, for sure. Like, upgrading from Hunt to Plumlee has been like massive for them, and it's going to be huge in this series. Like, that's like the post-up game was a huge negative in Hunt's game. Like, he was super inefficient down there.
Turnovers as well, a bit of everything.
Oh, like, a ton of turnovers, yeah.
Brett. No, you go.
The thing with the rebounds is, you know, that's probably the biggest part of the series, really, is going to be extra possessions. Because Cairns have the worst defensive rebounding rate in the league, I think. One of the worst turnover rates in the league. Perth have the best offensive rebounding rate and the best turnover rate in the league. So, like, there's a huge chance in this series that the Wildcats just win because they have 5 or 10 more chances to score the ball in each game.
Mm. Going back to Plumlee, have you liked his play in the, what, 6-7 games he's played?
Yeah, I think I do really like him. I'm not sure if he himself can fix the idea of helping off Damian Martin, because Machado can always just help down and double Plumlee and force him to kick it out if they need to.
I've got here written, is he an antidote to the defensive problem in the thing? And you've answered that for me. I mean, on that play as well, the video, Majuk is in no man's land defensively. This is when Damian Martin's on defense, that video. Machado comes off, I think, a screen. Martin gets beaten, and then Machado just makes his way to the hoop where neither one really strongly commits. Majuk's on the split line, but doesn't make that play. And I feel like Plumlee just absorbs that. He's the better defender of the two, don't you agree?
Oh, for sure. And he just adds a whole another level of length there as well. Majuk's, what, 6'6", is he?
Majuk for the Wildcats. Yeah. He's pretty big, but no, he's not Plumlee, that's for sure. Cotton struggled against Cairns. I think you wrote in your article he sort of averaged around the sort of 16 points, which is what, down about 4 or 5 points from average, which is substantial. Is it solely due to the attention of sagging off Martin, or is there something else at play that you noticed?
I think it played a part, but I think it's just more that Cairns are just a really good, versatile defensive unit in general. Like, they can throw out any coverage and succeed. Like, all their guys are really, really versatile, really quick, really athletic. They can switch everything, and they can throw any team out of their normal rhythm. And, like, I think actually another part of it is that DJ Newbill is just really, really good defensively. Like, when you have him draped all over you, it obviously makes it hard to score.
When you watched it again, did they tether minutes? Was Newbill and Cotton on the court all the time, or did they switch it up? I can't recall.
From memory, I think in one of the games they might have done that, but I can't remember completely.
Not a problem. Let's jump on to the second point in your article. You wrote, can Dean Vickerman force the Kings out of their comfort zone? Brad, take it away.
So the idea behind that was that Sydney have gotten to where they are on the ladder predominantly on the back of their D, and the biggest part of that defense is that drop-back scheme where...
Yeah.
No matter what, and their guards chase the ball handlers over screens and force them into mid-range. And on the back of that, Sydney's defense has registered like easily the lowest proportion of opponent shots coming from three or the rim, which just gives them a huge math advantage going into every game. So in my opinion, if anyone's going to beat them, they'll probably have to force Sydney out of that defensive style, or at least force some sort of adjustment. Because otherwise, I think the Kings will just have too much of a numbers advantage in every game. That's kind of their comfort zone to me.
My question to you is, and I didn't have this on the rundown, so apologies, but Did you watch the Boomers New Zealand game that New Zealand won just recently?
I did.
Did you see anything there from Will Weaver that suggested to you that he's likely or unlikely to make a tactical change?
In that game, he didn't. He obviously didn't have Bogut or Kickett. He had what was it? Dane Pinot and
Hodgson.
Who was Hodgson? Yeah, I can't actually recall whether they were running the same sort of scheme. So, but I mean, they got torn apart. So
for a number of reasons. Yeah, no, I thought maybe there was something there. I personally didn't. I don't know. We'll talk about it later on, but I'll bring it up slightly. I just feel with this series, it's very much of which coach is going to not only have the foresight to see a change, but have the courage to make it. But we'll get to that later because that's the money point. Diverging from the finals a little bit, did you think Melo Trimble was hard done by not being in that 15 selection for MVP?
Ooh. He had a couple of really awesome stretches throughout the season. Like, towards the end, I think he was really good, and about halfway through the season, if I remember correctly, he had a really, really good run of games.
He had a horrible stretch as well, sort of third of the way, two-thirds of the way through the season as well.
Yeah, the one that got him benched, eh?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So I think there's a case there that he should have been included on that shortlist, especially since it's a 15-man shortlist. So, I probably, for me, I don't think he was quite consistent enough.
Even the obvious switch I had was Jerome Randall, and maybe I'm being swayed by the comments that Joey Wright has come out and said, and just the disharmony that seemingly existed in that team. That would have been the most likely switch for me. I don't feel like Trimble had – he had a stretch of six atrocious games, but then played well in the others. I don't know. Maybe I'm off my hinges.
Yeah.
Sean Long. What will be the role of Sean Long in this series? In your piece, you spoke about the need for him to avoid the outside shot. He just doesn't – that Sydney wished to concede it, and he doesn't really seem to make it that much. I'm of the opinion that offensive rebounds keep him on the floor in this series. Would you agree, or do you have a different take on Sean Long's presumed impact?
I think it's a win for Sydney every time he attempts an outside shot, but I don't think he should avoid them altogether. I think because those shots are going to be wide open, and if he doesn't shoot them, Sydney just won't respect him when he's standing along the arc. And Melbourne will, their spacing will just go to tatters probably. I think with the offensive rebounding thing, I think Sydney just crash everybody on the defensive glass. I think Sander noted that on Twitter recently. Mm-hmm. They have they're the best defensive rebounding team in the league by quite a long way, I think. And for Melbourne, they were the best offensive rebounding team in the comp for the first few rounds of the season. But since about halfway through, that rate, from what I've observed, has dropped really quickly.
So Why do you suppose?
I think that Vickerman's now prioritizing transition defense. So I think he's just telling his guys to get back. That I haven't actually looked at that particularly in depth. Close, but
that's your suspicion.
Yeah. So I'm not – it might actually be – better in Vickerman's eyes if Long isn't getting offensive rebounds.
Right. Because I looked at it, and I looked at maybe a simplistic view, but he had one offensive rebound combined in the three losses, and he had five alone in the one win. Now, I can't remember if those five offensive rebounds in the win were of the Moses Malone ilk, where he's put a layup up, missed it, put a layup up, missed it. I can't remember, but...
yeah.
It did sort of jump out to me, but more than the five in the win is the one in all the losses combined. 0.3 of an offensive rebound in three contests. When that's down on his season average. I guess for me with Sean Long, it all starts with, is he willing to set picks with purpose? Well, firstly, play defense. He has been known to wander, but definitely, on offense, definitely. But on offense, is he willing to set a strong pick and roll really hard to the basket, even if it's unlikely he'll catch the ball, just to kind of make Bogut in that drop situation really think about it and create just not a mid-range shot, but a shot where Bogut cannot even semi-contest it or something. Well, how do you feel about that?
Oh, definitely. The main thing, obviously, he does need to roll hard and set really solid screens. He tends to sort of fade in and out of doing that. And on D, lately I think he's actually been a bit better on D. He's been moving his feet pretty well on the perimeter. He's contesting shots. If he's doing that against Sydney, like, that'll keep him on the floor for sure. I'm just a little bit skeptical that he will.
Defensively, honest. You're skeptical he'll step up to that defensive plate?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
Just his track record throughout the two seasons. Yep. You just see too many games where he's just not really paying attention or making the wrong call.
Mm. I think I even saw it in a timeout of the Cairns game, so their second last game of the year, where someone just got away from him. I forget who made it. Was Cam Oliver, made a big dunk, and he was in Asia space, and Vickerman called a timeout immediately, went into the bench and said, like, this is our season, you can't effing float around. And it was I think
that was that was the best timeout talk of the whole season, I reckon.
Yeah, I heard that and thought, oh, and I didn't think, and it's not like the dog you hit on the nose of the newspaper. I just feel like Sean Long needs that sort of assertive instruction. Players do. And I don't think it was demonstrative or terrible. It was candid and it was coarse. But, why did you like that timeout? What did you like about it so much?
Oh, I just like it when Dean Vickerman gets angry. I just find it really funny.
You're a pretty happy man then. My next question is going furthermore into this series. Do you have an explanation for how and why Casper went off on Melbourne repeatedly this season? He was 54% from the outside against Melbourne exclusively, and against everybody else, removing his Melbourne numbers, he was 26% from the outside against everyone else. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I don't think I can explain it at all, to be honest. I watched those games back in preparation for the article, and to be honest, the shots that he's hitting in those games seem to be pretty much the same degree of difficulty as the shots that he misses in every other game.
Yep, agreed. Especially the game he went 8 of 15 against them. He just was firing up stuff from court to court.
Yeah. So you'd guess that he regresses to the mean. And Melbourne have a really good stock of perimeter defenders, like Shaley and Mitch and McCarron are elite. And Mello Trimble's been a bit better than expected this season as well. And against other high-scoring guards around the league, they play them really well. Like, their Deion Cotton is always really good this season, especially, I think.
I mean, the only explanation you can give is that Hollywood answer that because he played for this team, there's bad feelings, and he plays well. I don't see any difference.
I do think he does take that quite personally, eh?
Oh, it certainly seems that way. And I think, the guy I speak to a lot is Body Nodge on this show, and he just says that Casper can at times over-emotionalize his game, and I think it works for his advantage against Melbourne. And everyone else, you can see it's – I really can't explain Casper. I mean, 26% from 56 it's a hell of a drop-off. You did say you expect him to regress to the mean in this series. I would assume that spells trouble or maybe even dire trouble for the Kings, or do you think there's a counter to if he doesn't shoot the ball so well?
I mean, even in the games that he was, like, shooting lights out, they were winning games by 20 or 30 points. So even if you, like, regress those stats to the mean in those games, I think they probably still win those regular season meetings. Mm. So it'll be interesting. Like, they'll need to get production from other places if he's not hitting. Guys like Xavier Cooks will have a step up.
That was my next thing. Liam Santamaria wrote an article. He talked, I think it was called NBL 20 Finals X Factors. He denotes Xavier Cooks as one of them. He's quite literally an X Factor, Xavier. However, 6 points per game on the season, 15% from the outside, 43% from the field for a bigger guy is, blasé. You talk about in your lineup, like forcing a different lineup. If Melbourne can force a smaller Sydney lineup, Cooks will be tested. And how do you think he will fare if that happens?
If the series goes small, I think it's definitely a Xavier Cooks series, because he'll be playing in more space on offense. He'll presumably get to the rim more. It'll be at a higher tempo. And on D, he's really sound at challenging shots at the rim and switching. So if the series goes small, I think I really like Xavier Cooks' chances to be one of the really key members of that.
You think, and if it does go small, you would still favour Sydney over Melbourne?
Yeah, as we'll get onto, I'm sure. It's just a bit of an interesting one, because neither team have gone small particularly often this season at all. Mm. So there's not a lot to go off, really.
Not a lot of case study, I understand. Let's shift gears. We've talked about the bigs and Casper Ware. Let's talk about Chris Golding in this series. My thought is this. He's got to get open to get his three-point attempts, because when he takes threes, he often makes them. I know that sounds pretty stupid to say, but in the three losses to Sydney, he went 5 of 16 from the outside, an average of 5 three-point attempts per game. In the win, the one win, I know it's not a big sample size, but nonetheless, went 4 of 12, shot 33%. His average season three-point attempts is 9.3, so well up on that 5.3 in the losses. When he gets three-point attempts, he usually makes them at a pretty good clip, and the structure of this offense, this Melbourne United offense, seems to click into place. And I think you look no further than the last couple of games, where he shot in the mid to low teens of three-point attempts in four of the last five, and they won all four in that instance. What do you expect from Chris Golding in this series?
So what I'd like to see Melbourne do in this series is really sort of just hand Chris Golding the keys. Like they have done in those last three games. Like for most of the season, Long and Trimble were the centerpieces of that offense, and Golding was sort of more in that spot-up secondary role.
Yeah.
He's obviously still really effective in that role, but like over the last three games, when their season was on the line, like you saw Melbourne turn to Golding and ask him to be the focal point of that offense. So, and in those three games, his shot attempts were up, he was handling the ball more, and I think as a result, that offense just flowed a bit better.
Mm. Do you think that was a result of, because this is the big thing, if they play Trimble, does that come at the expense of Chris Golding? Is that why you've seen that, or is there something else at play?
I guess when they share the floor, like it doesn't allow Golding to handle the ball as much,
right,
which would be the only sort of downside to playing them together. At the same time, though, Melo has the ability to just take over any game at any time, really.
Yeah. I felt like when, in those last couple of games, when Golding's looked at his best, is when he is doing it off the ball. I just saw more sort of real focus on him coming hard off screens off the ball or cutting a particular angle. Earlier in the year, like I remember him just casting up a lot of sort of threes off dribble, step backs. That's not really – that. Whether they're his shot or not, it's kind of irrelevant. They're just not a good shot for anyone to take, unless, of course, if you're Casper Ware. I think that he
– Only against Melbourne, though.
Only against Melbourne, pardon me. He just needs to, Golding just needs to, yeah, as you say, just be the focus of the offense. Because even when he takes the threes but doesn't make them, their offense just seem to click into place. What do you think about that? Like, even if he's not making it, they're better with him as the focus.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think the ball also just moves a little bit better when he's sort of the target of the offense. I don't like the offense as much when it's sort of the Melo and Long show.
Mm.
And they're sort of going into those isolation sets. It's just... ball gets a little bit sticky, and yeah,
plus I think that Sydney is so, they're so trained in how what they're doing on the pick and roll, like they just, that has been the focus of Weaver's preseason, just from the look of it. I don't know if that's exact, but just from the look of it, so yep, they're comfortable in that. It's other stuff that's going to throw them off, and as you say, it's about making that change and getting out of that comfort zone. I wanted to ask a question off the grid here. Stanton Kidd, have you liked his play? Do you see his effectiveness? Has he been underutilized? What do you think about him?
He's a really interesting guy in this series, because if it goes small, they'll have to rely on him playing the four quite a bit. And right, that's something that I think Vickerman's been a little bit reluctant to do so far. Mm-hmm. But like, I think the reason why they got him in, him specifically, was that he could play both spots effectively.
Yeah. David Barlow, like, sort of been the way of this team, and maybe it's been confused with the fact that Chris Golding's got off in the last sort of four games and had his shots and had his looks. But at the same time, Dave Barlow's been effective. I don't know if one's a symptom of the other, or if. But Dave Barlow, what do you see happening with him in this series?
Yeah, that Barlow. It's going to be hard for him to match up against Jayshon Tate, which is the obvious sort of the elephant in the room here. Like, Tate's just he's a different animal. Like,
has anyone been effective against him? Honest question.
That's the thing. Like, no, yeah, I haven't actually seen a single game where I've been like, there, this guy's got Tate's number.
The only thing I can suggest is the games that he's performed poorly in, or quote unquote poorly, is the games he's fouled out in. I think he fouled out New Zealand and fouled out at another occasion. I mean, it sounds pretty simple equation. If a player is good, make him foul out and get off the court. Like, duh, but maybe that's the answer. Does Stanton Kidd engage him on defense more? I don't know. My question is.
When Kidd's playing the four, he's a better ball handler than Barlow from what I've seen. Like, he attacks the rack a little bit more. So that could definitely trouble Tate a little bit more, I guess. Yeah.
Mm. Let's jump onto the third dot point in your article. It's titled, Can Mike Kelly Find the Right Front Court Rotation? Do you mind taking the listeners through that one, Brad?
Yeah, so like what I was thinking there is that Cam Oliver, Defensive Player of the Year candidate, he matches up really well with everyone, super athletic. But I just don't like their other options against that particular Perth front court.
Mm.
Like, I don't like how Deng matches up with Kay. Like, Kay is going to maul him on the offensive glass and in the post. And I think Jawai is just going to be picked on all series long, really.
Mm. The obvious banner in the works here is Kwat Noi. He's been missing for so long. You know, what effectiveness has he come back into this with? I guess my thought when I first read this dot point of yours in the article, I feel like the goal with the Wildcats is to limit Bryce Cotton at any cost. Like, that has to be your focus. If you let him get off, it's over. So I think you kind of – so my question to you is, if you're picking your poison between playing certain lineups that are advantageous against Cotton as opposed to letting Kay get off, where do you sit? You lean more towards like, oh, let's do something more about this Kay matchup than against Cotton, or not so much?
The point that you made there about sort of trying to get your rotation as acclimatized to defending Cotton as possible is really interesting, because if they went with Noi at the four, say, they could switch really effectively across the perimeter, sort of just throw Cotton way off, maybe. That could be of some use, and then you maybe just throw out the Kay matchup and let Kay get his, but maybe stop Cotton from exploding.
Mm.
And that's probably the lesser of two evils if you're Mike Kelly.
I do think so, because I think, and this is just my eye test sort of stuff, I look at Nick Kay and I see a player who is a super solid 20 and 10. I just don't think anyone can stop him getting 20 and 10 in these finals in any game.
Yeah.
But I don't think
his minutes in the mid to high 30s.
Precisely. And I think he's not that player who I've never seen him explode for 35, 40. Like, I've seen Cotton just explode games apart. You can kind of weather the storm with Nick Kay. If you try and weather the storm with Cotton, you're just going to get blown away. The question I had for you, Brad, is Nate Jawai. Like, he's the obvious answer to the boards and the defense. He can go to Plumlee, shifting Oliver down to play Kay. That matchup would presumably be better than Bajuk Deng or likewise. Mm-hmm. At first, I was really like that. I thought, oh, yeah, that'll secure the boards as well, because we talk about how this team's a bad defensive rebounding team. Now I'm not so keen on it. I just think Cotton in a pick and roll with Jawai, that's not going to go well. Where do you see Nate Jawai? What would you do?
I think the more that I think about it, I wouldn't play him against when Perth goes small. I'd keep him away. I'd send him to the tunnel. I just wouldn't have him anywhere near that lineup.
Okay.
But when Perth are a bit bigger and they're crashing the offensive glass, you'd obviously like Jawai's rebounding out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like him trying to defend a Cotton Plumlee pick and roll, just because Plumlee's super athletic. He's got,
can go up and get it like high.
Yeah, exactly. Jawai can't get up that high anymore, or maybe ever. But and then defending in space Cotton, that's just a recipe for disaster. I think if you're Mike Kelly, you're probably going to only play Jawai when Majuk's back out there.
Right, which is about probably 10 minutes a game, though. Like, is that enough? Can you get more out of him, is my question.
Yeah, I'm sure in game one they'll try him out against different lineups just to see what it looks like. But I think they'll probably end up realizing that they just will have to go with something else.
I think the big sort of thing for Mike Kelly to consider is, do you kind of tether him with Plumlee? And if you do that, do you start him? Do you start with a Jawai, Oliver, Machado, Newell, Jerich lineup and just sort of play the two, but even then, you know, you and I, we don't really like him against Plumlee either. So, yeah, you're right when you say it. Maybe Majuk is the time when they see each other. Changing speeds a bit. Turnovers. Cairns Taipans commit the most in the league at 13.9. Perth Wildcats the least, 10.0. So that's almost a 4 turnover discrepancy. That's 4 turnovers. That's 4 shots. That's potential 8 points. You know, 8 points would be, I haven't looked at the average score discrepancy, you know, in a win, what's the average winning margin in the NBL, but I'm guessing it'd be around 8 points. That number just rings a bell. Why do you think that is with Cairns? Why do you think they commit so many? And are you surprised that a team led by Scott Machado, who's a really good point guard, is seemingly so careless with the ball?
It's a little bit of a weird one, I guess. I guess the best explanation for it would be that just their style of play is, you know, run and gun. They force the issue. Maybe that just leads to more turnovers, but I don't really have another explanation outside of that, to be honest.
No, neither. I think maybe the other thing is Machado gets a little bit of heat off picks, but sometimes occasionally he's sort of doubled or hedged, leaving Cam Oliver to be a little bit more of a decision-making big. He's high in turnovers this season. I think I wrote it down somewhere. We'll get to it. Oh, yeah, here it is. Oliver's 14th in turnovers. I think like 2.2, 14th for the year. I mean, he plays a lot of minutes. So I don't know that's a lot. But him and Plumlee actually lead the league for turnovers amongst bigs. Yeah, that was the thing. The double decision-making by the two. Offensive rebounds. We spoke about this just quickly before, but the Cairns Taipans grabbed the second least. Perth grabbed the third most. This culminates in Cairns having the worst defensive rebound percentage. Why do you suppose that is?
I mean, they're a little bit smaller, which is probably the main problem with that. Oliver's not always engaged on the defensive glass, although I think he's been a lot better since the first sort of quarter of the season, since they really started to win. And then Deng's obviously, he's a little bit frail on the defensive glass. It's more their personnel than anything, I'd just say. Yeah.
I think I've written here, the question for me of this series is going to be on the backboard. Actually, departing from this, and I should have given you a heads up about this as well, have you listened to a podcast called Thinking Basketball? I think it's called Thinking Basketball. And it had an episode called Should the Board Man Get Paid? Have you heard this?
I did, actually. Yeah. It was a month or two ago, was it?
Yeah, about that. Yeah. It was a really interesting little thing where he talks about, like we talk about in the press, they'll go, Jawhai had 10 points, 8 rebounds. And rebounds is the second stat that they list, but is it that important? Does it warrant being that major statistical pillar of you look immediately at points, rebounds, and assists? I know it's a bit off field and I haven't prepared you for it, but what did you think about that article? And if you can, as it relates to this series, or is that too abstract a thought? But go for it, Brent.
I think the sort of counting rebound stats are quite overrated. I think if you're going to measure rebounding in any sort of metric, you've got to look at the overall defensive rebounding percentage. And how a team's impacted when a specific player is on the floor. Because obviously rebounding's, you know, if a player's boxing out but not getting rebounds, that's still a positive for you ultimately.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've often looked at it. I meant to actually go through and jot down every contested. That's what we should start. I think this is a new stat I'd like to bring in. Contested rebounds. And it sort of leans more towards what you're talking about, where a person blocking out for their team is a defensive help. If a player, how many rebounds are there 50-50 balls? Because they matter when a shot goes up and your team either gets it or you concede it to the other team. How many of those would be in the average game? I'm going to actually, probably not in these final series, but at some point sit down and look at how many rebounds go both ways. I think with more three-point shots, that number would go down. I mean, obviously you shoot a three-point shot, it goes long. That's why you see a lot of more guards rebound, but I thought that was a really interesting podcast. So if you're listening out there, definitely go to it. It's called Should the Board Man Get Paid? And obviously, offensive rebounding, Perth is so good at it because is it because it's their focus or is it because it's their aptitude? Like the likes of Kay, does he just drag that number up or do they get it across the board to your eye, Brad?
Actually, on Twitter, Tony Loidi, I think is how you
pronounce his name. Oh, he's great. I've spoken about Tony before. He's amazing.
Yeah, he did a good analysis, a good Twitter thread on this. Perth just sort of, they just send everyone. Well, they send, not everyone, but they send a lot of pressure on the offensive boards every game. And it's a big reason why their offensive rating is number one at the moment.
I had a theory. This is what I've written here. For me, this series does hinge on the backboard. Can or will Cam Oliver, Majuk Deng, and Kouatnoy maintain their focus on the mission of stopping Kay and Plumlee mopping up the backboard? And to a lesser extent, or someone you talk about your X factors, we'll talk about that later, Majuk. It's a matter of aptitude versus attitude in this series. I know that sounds a bit sort of Hollywood-like, do they want it? But it is a question of can they maintain mental focus, you know, at one end trying to score, but at the other end being like, all right, I have to maintain a body on Nick Kay all the time. Because Nick Kay will. He will never, ever – he's like the Terminator. He won't, he won't eat or sleep. He will just keep going. He's got one singular focus, and he just keeps doing it over and over again. And to me, with you couple the defense, the rebounds, with the turnovers, and I'm not optimistic for Cairns in this series. And I call the Wildcats a toothpaste team. No matter how little chance of a win there is in the toothpaste, it could be all the way at the bottom, they will find a way to slowly but surely grind it out, whether they have to roll it, squeeze it, you know, push the top. It's a silly analogy, but that's the way I see it. Do you see it similar, or do you think there's more chance of an upset with Cairns and Perth?
Well, whenever I'm thinking about the Wildcats and that sort of that toothpaste analogy you're making there, I always think, as a Breakers fan, the 2015-16 finals, that's the series where Damian Martin sort of just, he won MVP in that series, I believe. And it was like probably the worst display of basketball, but it was just, it was just Perth just grinding everything out, going 100% on every single offensive rebound, just doing that. And I think it's probably going to be, that's how they play. And that's, I think, what we're going to see in this series.
And then added onto that is just the offensive brilliance of Cotton. If I can diverge from what I've got written here, he won MVP. Do you see an issue with that? Or I just think he is far and away the most, had the best year, was the most talented, and just is the best player in the league by so very, very far.
Oh yeah. I think this was definitely Bryce Cotton's best year in the league. And I think he was a very deserving MVP. I think purely even based on the fact that Perth had the league's best offense. And for most of the season, it was by far the best offense. And Cotton's the biggest part of that. He's the leader of that team, and the whole system's designed, based on the fact that he's incredible at basketball.
You say that as well, and they've got a great defensive rating. I mean, I look at someone like Tariqo White had a down year, even on last year, which was a down year that he then turned around. With Tariqo White, do you see anything like his turnaround last year in the finals? And I know this is off grid, so I'm throwing it at you, but
yeah,
his finals last year, did you see that as a result of just that Hollywood, like he just stepped up to the occasion, or did you see something in the way those games were played that led to his success, or a bit of both?
Tariqo is probably, his final series last year was like the weirdest thing. It was completely different to how he played the rest of the year. I think part of it is that during the playoffs, you're going to see teams definitely, focusing on Cotton. They're going to be throwing double teams his way. They're going to be, the whole defense is going to be structured to prevent him from going off. So maybe that just takes a little bit of pressure off Tariqo come playoff time, more than it does in the regular season.
But he does even his international play, he's always done this. He's always gone, 15, 17 points in the regular season and then upped it by, almost a quarter. He just seems to do this at every stop he's been. Let's go to the fourth dot point from your article. The title is, Will the Kings Tether Bogut to Long? Tell the people what you're thinking is there.
Yeah, so what I was thinking was that, so I wrote an article, I think 2 weeks ago, and basic idea behind the article was that the Kings have used their bench to get where they are at the moment, even more so than their stars. Especially when you look at the on-off numbers and what their best lineups are like. And I think as much as possible, Weaver will try to stick to his regular season rotations that were really successful during the regular season in the playoffs. But If you look at the Kings versus United games from the regular season, the Kickett versus Long minutes were not great for the Kings, especially in that first game where Long was just a monster on the glass. You know, he was going after everything in the post.
Mm.
And I just wonder whether if Weaver's going to break up his usual rotations to make Bogut, to up Bogut's minutes, tie him to Sean Long, or they'll just roll the dice and keep their regular season rotations and hope that Kickett can match up with Long. That's the basic question.
This was my favorite part of your article. And this gave me the most pause for thought, which is always in short supply in this world. So I appreciate it. What will happen? What do you think will happen? Will Long play more than his 27 minutes average? I mean, him and Vickerman have had this to look beyond the numbers now. And he and Vickerman have had this, maybe you could call it strained, maybe you could call it odd relationship where he's been totally taken out of games, put into games. He's never been that steady starter like a Cam Oliver who gets 30 to 35 minutes a game. It's just never been that way for him.
Yeah.
What do you think happens? Who do you think changes their ways, Weaver or Vickerman?
I think part of the long minutes thing is that at the end of the games, Vickerman comes to defend. I think during these playoffs, you know, you got to rely on your best players to win you these games. And I think Vickerman will bump up his minutes probably close to the 30s. Well, closer to the 30s.
Yeah.
Probably not an excessive amount, but I have a feeling that Vickerman's probably the more likely one to change, yeah.
I think so too, for a number of reasons. They're the fourth seed. They're less likely. Plus, I feel like we're talking about the New Zealand Boomers game before. Looking at that, I think Will Weaver is the more stern of the two. I really, and Weaver has been militant to the point of he takes Casper Ware out at a certain point in the first quarter, and I've seen him come out after immediately making a shot. He is very regimented in his lineups. It's really amazing because this dot point he was, as I said, gave me a lot of pause for thought because, you know, the big narrative around the NBL is that your starters win. You look at New Zealand, right? We were talking about it before we started recording. Yeah. They hit success when there was clear and precise and really intensified role definition. When those starters started to hit the 30 minutes a game and Ashley was up in the 30, like no, you know, none of them were under 30. When that started to happen, they got success. Look at the other side of the coin, Cairns. They got success when Machado, Newball, Oliver have played 30 plus and a few other starters as well. It's a real question of how valuable, maybe I'm casting too wide a net, but how valuable is bench depth in the NBL and in particular in the NBL finals? And this series more than ever is going to show that and coach's emphasis on that. I've just got here. It's a question of coaching temperament, who's most likely to change. And we both agree it'll be Vickerman. Let's jump on. The fifth dot point in your article was, will any role players explode? You offer up three role players you feel have the most favorable opponent matchup to have a breakout series or season. Those three are Majuk of Perth, Mirko Jerich of Cairns Taipans, Didi Lazada. Of the three, who do you feel is the most likely to break out and why?
I like this Didi matchup for Sydney.
Likewise.
In the article, I mentioned that, you know, Melbourne have some very good perimeter defenders, but they'll only be, you know, Sydney have so many threats on the perimeter. Casper Ware, Xavier Cooks,
Tade, you know,
Kevin Lish,
Julie,
Sean Bruce. I have a feeling that whenever Lazada's on the floor, he's going to get the third best perimeter defender.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you like that.
That'll sometimes be Chris Mello Trimble. Yeah, and I think Didi's just going to have a great matchup in this series whenever he's on the floor. Who knows how many minutes he's actually going to play because of how deep the Kings are. But I do really like that matchup for him.
Didi, to play sort of devil's advocate, I think Didi is a strong case. I'm going to say Mirko Jerich. I think not so much that I think he'll explode, but I think if he does explode and go well, Cairns are going to be a threat to beat Perth. I don't see it happening, but he's the one where, again, there's that offensive pressure on or defensive priority on Machado, Oliver, Newbel, that he's that guy left out. And I think Perth are a real cutthroat team or real one eye where they're going to be like, all right, if he's going to kill, we are going to allow you to play. And if you kill us, you kill us. I think Perth are that sort of militant in the way they play. So I think he's going to get plenty of shots. Whether he makes them is the big one. Majuk is the third name you throw up. I think he's a consideration, but again, I feel like unless Plumlee gets into foul trouble, is he going to see more than the 10 minutes he's become accustomed to through the year? That is my question.
The idea with Majuk as a breakout player is I can just imagine like a game two in the series on the road where he comes off the bench for 10 minutes and he just gets six offensive boards in 5 minutes or something stupid like that.
And just pops them all back in. Yeah, no, fair case. Absolutely. When you look at that defensive rebounding percentage of the Cairns type, it makes sense. Didi, my only skepticism is his health. I mean, he's missed a lot of time. He's been banged up. Yeah. And the physicality of the finals is going to test him big time. That's one. And then two, like with the time he sat out, where does he now sit in this rotation? To depart from that, do you have something to say, Brad?
Oh, no. I was actually just going to say it. It's both him and Kevin Lish. We don't really have a lot of evidence.
That was my next question with Lish. Yeah. Like, what do you make? How many games has he played? Like five, six?
It's in single digits, I'm pretty sure.
Unbelievable. And not big minutes in those games either. Yeah, really interesting. Because I understand that, and I've asked Taylor this himself, Lucas Walker was ill. And that was who Taylor was replacing. And I understand that Walker is better. I saw a tweet where he was dunking in practice. So unless he's got the flu and dunking in practice as well, maybe. So it's my understanding that Taylor's no longer an injury replacement and therefore no longer on the Sydney Kings. Right. I'll try and confirm or deny that. Does that change anything for you if he's not around?
Well, he's been lights out this last month, I'd say. His 3-point percentage has like gone through the roof. It'd be a loss. I mean, Walker's a very good player. I'd probably rather have the extra perimeter defender though against Melbourne just to chase
Melbourne, or more than likely your next series candidate, which is Perth Wildcats, or even it's Machado. So I sneakily, your article again is called "Sneaky Big Questions for the 1920 Finals." I think this is a real sneaky, I think they're going to really miss Taylor. I really do, because now you're putting a huge amount of emphasis on, in particular, Lish, who just hasn't played, and Lozada, who's been, is a much younger guy. I mean, he's 20 years old and going into a finals and the physicality that demands, that's a huge step up required from him. I think that's going to be really interesting. Now, I can't confirm or deny whether it's true, but I'm leaning towards he's not going to be there. Anything else to add on him?
Yeah, well, I think with the added minutes for Didi and Lish, it's the hardest thing for them is going to be replacing Taylor's defense.
Mm. Yeah, agreed. And then Sean Bruce, do you see him being
really good defensively all year?
Oh, sorry, Brad, you dropped out. Yeah.
Sorry, my bad.
All good. You were saying?
Sean Bruce is. He's been, for me, one of the most impressive players in the league. I think I probably would have voted him for most improved player, even. Right. Even sixth man of the year, possibly both. Could have done the Tarangi. He'll play a big role in the series no matter what, I think. That they love those two guard lineups with him and Ware both on the court, and his connection with Kickett this season has been pretty incredible.
Mm.
So, I expect his minutes to stay pretty much the same.
I think Bruce, now with Taylor out, they're really pushing their chips on Bruce and Lish. And it's a fine experiment. We'll see how it goes. Let's conclude this thing up, Brad. If I gave you or someone gave you $1 million to bet on one of these two teams causing the upset, be it Melbourne or Cairns, who would you bet on and why?
It's a weird one. I think Cairns are the better team of those two.
Mm-hmm.
But when was the last time Perth lost a playoff series at home?
I don't know, but a long time ago.
Yeah, I can't think of it. So like for that reason, I'd probably lean Melbourne just because I can't see Perth losing a home playoff series.
Mm, but neither.
That, that, that's not any indication of how I feel about Cairns, really. But yeah, that's just how I'm leaning at the moment, I guess.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. I don't have a lot of stock in Cairns, if I can stick my neck out on that a bit. And not, again, not because I don't like their team, just because Perth have the home court, they win at home, and I actually think they'll probably wrap it up in two. I just feel the youth of Cairns and that backboard and the turnovers, when the pressure gets greater, I don't think they get any better at those two things, but we'll see. And also, Melbourne, do you have, what's your level of optimism of them causing an upset?
Well, if Casper Ware's shooting percentages regress like we think, then there's definitely an opening there. Mm. Because their defense has been really good the last couple months, Melbourne.
Mm.
And if Casper's not shooting lights out, and they can, and their defense still stays as high as it's been, I can see a universe where Sydney just really struggle to put the ball in the basket.
Yeah, same. Yeah, no, I agree.
Now that means Melbourne are going to be favored, but I don't know. But I think there's at least a path there for Melbourne to win this series.
Yeah, no, I agree. Let's look at this place. So do you think there'll be an upset, or who do you have making the grand final?
Oh, I hate to be boring, but I think it will be Sydney and Perth.
Yeah, I agree.
I just think they're the two best teams.
Quickly, your thoughts on if that eventuality comes true. Like, is there one thought that immediately sparks in your mind when you hear Sydney-Perth grand final?
Oh, just how Perth have played them in every single game this year. Well, the last three, I think, where Cotton exploded in all three. The drop back defense kind of hurt Sydney quite a bit, and Bogut was kind of played off the floor in one of those, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Now, we'll reserve talk for that later on. Brad, thanks very much. Before you go, I just wanted to chat. A lot of people who listen to the podcast are also into, like, sort of sports journalism as a hobby or even career. They get in touch with me about stuff. So when you wrote this article, I just wanted to kind of know, like, what's your writing process? So when you first came up with this idea, well, actually, I'll start before that. How did you come up with the idea for the article?
Well, in the preseason, I did a sneaky big questions for the whole season article. And that article was sort of just me jotting down a bunch of things that I'm kind of interested in, but not interested in enough in to go into a full article kind of thing.
Sure.
So this is sort of like a spin-off of that article, if you'd like to call it that. And it's just me sort of just diving into little bits and bobs of each series, none of which will, you know, actually decide the thing, but I think it'll at least play a role in the outcome.
And what's your writing process? So let's say you come up with a sneaky big question, whether it's Damian Martin turning into a negative, let's say. Do you then immediately go back and watch the games, or do you kind of look at stats? Like, what's your when you go from research shifting into writing, what do you do?
Yeah, I tend to look at the stats first, just to see like how a player performed against a specific team that season, and then I look at the film to try to understand why. That's always what I'm trying to do with these sort of analysis type pieces, is just trying to figure out that why.
Here's another question I had. Like, have you played basketball at a high level, Brad?
Oh, not at a high level, no.
No. Here's something it's interesting. Like, how do you contend with sort of that thing of, a lot of people will say, oh, we got our next player, so it doesn't matter. How do you sort of contend with that? And do you, in the sense of, how do you put your case forward, even though you don't have that profile behind you? You know, are you mindful of that, or how do you sort of counter that?
I mean, like, obviously ex-players have a big advantage in that regard. They know systems, they know the league a lot better. But I do think it does help to have sort of like an outside perspective, a guy that, you know, doesn't really have many ties anywhere, and just is a bit of a nerd who sits watching games at home.
Mm. Yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, obviously I'm not an ex-player, but I think that we're all watching the same game. Like, it's on television, anyone watch it. And honestly, sometimes I really do like to just sort of jab people who've never watched the sport, because sometimes they'll say something. And I call it the grandmother test. Like, if you go to your grandmother, like, oh, who's the best players? Name some basketball players. She'll go Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal, LeBron James, and Andrew Gates. They're the only names that permeate through to her. So you go, okay, I know where the zeitgeist is at. Like, and if you offer up those four names, they're really good names of basketball. You know, so you get something that, you know, whereas if you ask someone who watches too many games, they might say like, oh, I like the impact of a such, you know, something too esoteric.
I reckon that's super valuable, just getting that sort of a casual perspective of like in these finals. You might, like, if you watched last season's finals, you'd come out of it and that was the only part of the NBL season you watched, you'd think Tirico White was the MVP. He was the greatest player that's ever lived, basically.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting experiment, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And then when you're writing, what's your process when you're getting down to these? Do you listen to music when you write? Do you write with a pen and pad? Are you on computer? How do you do it?
Laptop. Just try to sort of drown everything out.
No distractions.
Music, but like on low, I guess. Just to
music with lyrics or music without lyrics, or it doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter to me. I've tried writing articles with a podcast going on in the background. Doesn't work.
No. I've tried doing anything. No. Yeah, unless you're gardening or something with your hands. No, not gonna happen.
Terrible. Yeah. But yeah, just try to sort of knuckle down, get the first draft done as soon as possible, then just go from there, sort of whittle it down.
And you say first draft, so you send that off to someone at the pick and roll and they review it and edit it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good. What else was I going to say? Actually, let's jump back. Let's, at the end here, let's throw shit against the wall, see what happens. Southeast Melbourne, we spoke about this. You wrote that article way back at the start of the year, and this is when I first contacted you. You were worried about the return of Ty Wesley. Or not worried about, but had questions about him. How did you see that playing out when he returned? I mean, it obviously, he came back and it coincided with a huge dip in form. We can put that down to a number of things, but what did you think following up on your article?
I don't think their dip in form has much to do with Ty Wesley. Like, their schedule got a lot tougher. They played a lot more road games as soon as he came back.
Yep.
Yeah. But I never really liked the fit of him with Creek. Particularly, because I always like Creek more when he's playing the small ball four, like he did for under Joey at the end of their tenure in Adelaide. I always like it when he's playing a little bit of a faster tempo with more space around him. I just feel like him and Wesley operate in a lot of the same spots on the floor almost. And then on defense, I like it. I just think they're a little bit slower with Wesley and Creek both on the floor at the three and four.
Tell me, do you like, but you don't like Wesley at a small ball five? You couldn't do you didn't like that. We didn't really see a lot of it, if I recall, but.
Well, the problem with Southeast Melbourne's roster construction, I guess, from that perspective, is that you've got Creek, Wesley, and then Dane Pinot, who was awesome this year. And trying to find minutes for all three of those guys playing their best position is really tough. Like, if you're going to play Wesley at the five and Creek at the four for long stretches, that means you're not giving as many minutes to Pinot. I guess that's sort of the problem that they've got.
I think the other problem they had was Ben Madgen didn't have the year he wanted. I just felt like
it was straight from the first game of the season, really, against Melbourne. That opener was just missing shots that you're usually accustomed to making.
And in a system that, like, if he wasn't going to excel in this system, it's kind of like, well, this was your train, you know, this was your bus, and it just didn't quite happen. I think he's would be more effective off the bench against secondary defenders or people who are a bit more tired. It's just something, you got to change it up with him. But I also felt like their biggest problem was Creek was the only guy who really attacked the basket. You know, Ty Wesley's more of a crafty guy, got to the hoop. Pinot's a bit of a banger off a rebound. John Robson looked really small going at the hoop. Like, Adam Gibson was an outside bomber. Imagine Kendall Stevens, I've been banging on about this all year, didn't attempt to tie a free throw the whole year.
That's been my favorite subplot of the whole season.
I saw that and I'm just like, 339 minutes. That's a long one free throw, not a tech foul, not a team foul situation. Not one. I just thought it was incredible. So I think that looking for them next year, they need more of, like, the only one who attacked the hoop was Creek, and they need someone at that spot who's a little bit more rangy, sort of like a Jay Crockett who they had, but less of a positional logjam with Creek and Wesley. I thought he overlapped a bit too much. The other one, I put up a tweet as well. I don't know if you saw it. It was about Keith Benson. It was a bit of a cheeky tweet. Right. I don't think – I wouldn't certainly suggest that once they got rid of him, he was the secret ingredient that kept them winning and resulted in them losing thereafter. But what did you think of Benson and if you saw my tweet?
You know, I kind of – I like Benson more than most, you know. Like, he was kind of like a, like, not as a starting, like, top tier center, but like, as a guy off the bench, I thought he did an okay job. Like, he was, you know, he's huge. Like, he gets after it on the boards. He
blocks shots.
He can contest shots, yeah. And he's a target on the pick and roll.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not sure that losing him though really had much of an impact on their season. But
no, I agree.
I did like him.
I think they would have won. I think they would have been better for having keeping him for a couple of reasons. One, I thought Walker. I think it's a bad situation. I can't imagine what it's like as a pro to just sort of get a phone call like, all right, you're heading to Southeast Melbourne now. They're three quarters of the way through their season and they're about to play 8 games on the road. Good luck. And they've got injuries. Yeah. It's like, what? It just wasn't a situation anyone does well. I thought they would have been best to, when Benson, they wanted to get off him early. When it didn't kind of work for them early, I just thought, well, they should just go on. Actually, we're going to put the boat in reverse. We're just going to sort of pull out of this.
This is us now.
This is us. We're not happy with it, but he knows our stuff. Let's just, you know, the train is on the tracks. It's very hard to just keep going. You may not go the speed you want, but you're on the tracks. That was everything to depart. But did you feel like your article, did you feel, pat yourself on the back a bit with your Southeast Melbourne article? Feel like, oh, I kind of got it right there.
I mean, a little bit, I guess. Like, as I say, I never really liked that fit between Wesley and Creek. We'll see how it works next year because I think Wesley's on a 2-year deal.
He's got 2 years left. I thought he's on a 3-year deal.
Oh, really?
I'll double check, actually, but you could be right.
It'll be interesting to see how they build the team next year, whether they go with a sort of Walker type on the wing again or they go a little bit bigger. I don't know, yeah.
All right, Brad. Well, thanks very much. Tell everyone where they can find you at.
You can find me on Twitter at BradWinter12.
Why 12, Brad? Sorry to interrupt.
It was my old basketball number, actually.
Okay, there you go.
on the pickandroll.com.au,
where
you can find my stuff and a whole bunch of other great writing as well.
Thanks very much for listening, everyone. A reminder, rate, review, and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can follow me on Twitter at MBLPocketPod. And Gmail, mblpocketpodcast@gmail.com, and on Facebook and YouTube and all those nice places. Thanks very much. Bye.